From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
I'm Madeline Brand. Today, oil prices are hovering around $130 a barrel.
And tomorrow, the Senate Judiciary Committee will be asking oil company executives what they can do about rising gas prices. All the presidential candidates talk a lot about energy independence.
That means relying on our own resources for energy and weaning ourselves off foreign oil. Proponents say achieving independence will end our reliance on unfriendly governments. It'll stabilize energy costs and clean up our environment. Well, not everyone agrees with that premise.
Energy writer Robert Bryce is managing editor of the Energy Tribune and a contributor to the Texas Observer. His new book is Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. Robert Bryce, welcome to Day to Day. Dangerous delusions?
Indeed it is, Alex. It is a dangerous delusion to believe that the U.S., the world's single biggest energy consumer, can be independent of the world's single biggest business, the $5 trillion a year global energy sector. It's idiotic.
You know that Congress passed an Energy Independence Act last year.
I do, yes. In December, the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007 achieved neither energy independence nor energy security, as far
as
I can tell.
Well, this is a process, you know. This is something that we're seeking to achieve as a nation. This is a goal that we've set for ourselves.
Well, have we, though? Richard Nixon talked about it in 1974 and promised it by 1980. Gerald Ford talked about it and promised that it would happen within 10 years. Look, this is a delusion because the global market for energy products of all kinds is completely integrated. Last year alone, the U.S. purchased oil or oil products from 90 different countries. That's in 2007, according to the Energy Information Administration. The U.S. exported oil or oil products to 73 countries last year. The fact is, it's a global market, whether we're talking about iPods, fresh flowers, bottled water, beer, or crude oil and gasoline. We need to accept the fact that we live in an interdependent world.
And what you're saying is we can't just stop buying oil from the people we don't like because it's all essentially one big oil pool out there, and if we don't buy it, someone else will.
Exactly. The fact is, according to the EIA, there are 173 countries in the world. Out of 204 countries and territories they track, 173 are net oil importers. We could drop out of the oil market tomorrow, and those 172 other countries would continue buying oil from the lowest cost producer. Again, it's an integrated market.
Robert, there's been a lot of anxiety over the last year about rising oil prices, right?
Sure.
Doesn't this seem like a crisis of some sort?
Well, I think a crisis would be if there were no supply. Yes, prices are high and prices are higher than people want to pay. But let's also put that in perspective. I wrote a piece that was published last week in Slate saying that $4 gasoline is cheap. And it is when you look at it in a historical perspective. Back in the early 1920s, on an inflation-adjusted basis, gasoline prices were over $3.10. So we're paying slightly more than that today. Why do we believe that we should pay less for our gasoline than our grandparents or great-grandparents did?
In your book, you say, look, we're stuck with oil. We're going to be an oil-dependent economy for the next 40, 50 years. Is there really nothing we can do to significantly lessen our dependence on that?
I think there are certain things we can do to reduce our oil consumption, but you can't use ethanol in a jet airplane. You can't use it to run diesel trucks. The fact is that it's taken us over a century to get where we are with the fossil fuels that we use, whether that's coal or petroleum, and it's going to take us decades to move away into something else. And we're not going to move to something else, whatever that is, whether it's a new type of motor fuel, whether it's electric cars or something else, unless or until those alternatives or renewables become cheaper, cleaner, more convenient than what we're using now.
Robert Bryce is managing editor of Energy Tribune. His new book is Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. He spoke with us from Austin, Texas. Robert, thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
The green tech sector is getting more crowded every week with companies promising that cheaper, cleaner, and more convenient energy alternative Robert Bryce talked about. One of them is Amyris Biotechnologies in Emeryville, California. Day to Day's Alex Cohen has more.
Neil Renninger, the chief technology officer at Amyris, is a man who's used to taking chances. When he was younger, he was one of those MIT students who made money playing blackjack in Vegas, a story recently made popular in the film 21.
What's the count?
Plus 9.
No.
Plus 11.
No.
Dude, I lost count 20 cards ago.
Don't call me dude.
Instead of counting cards, Renninger is now betting that he can turn sugarcane into a cheap, clean biofuel. That's one of the projects being worked on at Amyris Biotechnologies, a company he and some of his postdoc buddies from UC Berkeley started 5 years ago. The name Amyris, he says, was inspired by a plant that's grown in the West Indies.
It makes an oil that smells a lot like sandalwood oil. Sandalwood oil is very expensive. Amyris oil is less expensive.
Amyris, the company, relies on a process called synthetic biology. They basically hack into microbes and manipulate them in order to produce certain molecules. Their first mission was to produce artemisinin. It's a wonder drug traditionally derived from the wormwood plant and used to treat malaria, but it's pricey.
So what we're doing is producing that drug in a microbe. Instead of extracting it from a plant, we extract the genes from the plant.
The result, artemisinin that's more than 50% cheaper than the traditional version. 2 years ago, Amyris began using that same cell hacking technology to develop fuel that could power jets and cars. In their labs on the fourth floor of a generic-looking office building, vacuum pumps churn in time to jazz that plays on the stereo. Lab technicians here are hard at work, engineering different strains of yeast.
So this is the first place we go to test a strain.
Renninger points to a machine that's violently shaking several glass flasks. Inside each flask is yeast that feeds off a solution of sugar water.
And as they grow, they produce more of themselves, and they produce the compound that we've engineered them to make.
That compound is a hydrocarbon fuel with the same molecular structure found in petroleum-based fuel. Renninger says their fermented sugar-based biodiesel may be a better option than corn-based ethanol.
When you make ethanol, you have to distill the ethanol. That's very energy intensive. When you're making a hydrocarbon, the separation is simplified. It's like oil and water. The separation is very easy, which means your impact on global greenhouse gas emissions is actually reduced.
And Renninger adds, unlike other alternative fuels currently being developed, their biodiesel can power engines already in use, and it can be transported using existing infrastructure. But right now, there's not a whole lot of their biodiesel. Renninger says to date, they've increased their yield by 10 million-fold. But when you're working in a relatively small lab with one cell at a time, that doesn't add up to much.
We're making on the order of liters to gallons to tens of gallons per batch.
That's about to change. Amyris Biotechnologies recently announced it will partner with a Brazilian company to start commercial production of sugarcane-based biodiesel. Their goal over the next 2 years is to be able to produce fuel at $55 to $60 a barrel, a price that will likely look good to consumers. Just this morning, oil was trading at a record $129 a barrel. Alex Cohen, NPR News.
So how soon would we be able to fill up on sugarcane-based biodiesel or any other oil substitute? Gary Waz studies the future of energy. He's the director of the University of Michigan's Memorial Phoenix Energy Institute. So, Mr. Waz, sugarcane-based biodiesel or corn-based, are those the best alternatives out there right now?
They may be the alternatives that are there now, but they're probably not the best. There are a lot of drawbacks to these types of sources of ethanol. Corn base, of course, competes with the food supply. You need prime agricultural land. And while ethanol has positives in replacing oil, it also has a very low energy value compared to gasoline. And part of this causes the economics or the greenhouse gas advantage to be very minimal for corn ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'd want to look towards something like cellulosic as a much better ethanol product down the line.
Is that switchgrass?
That's right.
Well, what else is out there? What else maybe holds more promise?
One of the most valuable energy forms is electricity. If you could imagine that we electrify our transportation system, which we're starting to now, we're on the path to do that, then you could actually use electricity generation not only for powering homes and businesses, but also for powering transportation. We're experimenting with hybrid cars around the world Very soon we'll see plug-in hybrid electrics, which will extend range to maybe 40 miles on a charge, and you should be able to plug these into your wall socket in your garage. And then beyond that, we may be seeing the full electric vehicle. So this really is a major transformation that's just beginning right now. One of the reasons it's so attractive is because you not only reduce your dependence on oil, which is a big problem, but you also give yourself the opportunity to attack the greenhouse gas issue. If you start looking at the front end, how we generate electricity and can replace that with renewables or nuclear energy instead of coal.
So we'd have to figure out how to produce that electricity cleanly.
That's right. People talk about alternative energy, and I think they generally mean renewables when they say that. But you have to keep nuclear energy in that mix as well, because it's frankly our only proven major electricity producer outside of coal.
Hmm. How far away are we from having a lot of our gasoline needs met by electricity?
Well, we're a long ways. And this is a cold reality. These things are going to take a lot of time.
Well, what would you suggest in the interim?
It depends on which evil you're trying to fix. In the energy world, I see two evils. One is we're over-dependent on oil as an energy source. And second, we're toying with changing our climate dramatically by the production of greenhouse gases. Now, if you fix the greenhouse gas problem, you're going to end up fixing the oil problem, because oil is a major source of greenhouse gases, about a third of them. You can approach the oil problem without solving the greenhouse gas problem. So assuming you want to do both, one of the things that we need to do in the interim is figure out how to manage carbon, because we are going to most probably use all the oil that's available to us and a lot of coal while we try and figure out how to make these cleaner technologies economical and large scale.
Gary Wuz is director of the University of Michigan's Memorial Phoenix Energy Institute. He looks at the future of energy. Thank you.
Hey, thanks very much.